Yeah, okay, welcome to the second part of the session. We're actually quite flattered that so many people returned. And it will be worth it, I hope, because right now, after we covered sort of most of the basics that we felt we would need, now we're going into actual application of all that stuff. First of all, we're going to talk about controlling timing, why you might want to do it, and what happens if you do it, and situations where you just have to do it. First of all, some terms. There's two meanings to the word timing. First is musical time feel, in the sense whether somebody plays sloppy, laid back, or tight. This is one meaning, and the other is the way two sound sources coincide. For instance, if my voice were relayed through two speakers to you and they were at different distance, they would hit you at different time. And this is the second meaning of that. So, and there's also that delay unit, which you can use in a studio or a digital delay. And you can use it for two different applications, basically. You can use creative delay, where you're more or less free to adjust it to your tastes. But sometimes it's also necessary to use corrective delay when you have an actual problem, and then you need to precisely calculate how to apply that. We can just come to that later. First of all, we've got to take a short aside about correlated signals. Signals are said to be correlated if there's a fixed phase relationship between them, which basically boils down to the fact that they came from the same source at some time or other and were relayed through different signal paths. Now, it can happen that those signals get misaligned, they get out of time. It can happen if, for instance, you use many microphones for a large band. If one player hears his own microphone, but the sound he produces will also be picked up by a microphone that's slightly farther away, which will give you timing differences. Or you have a single microphone which picks up both direct sound and reflected sound from somewhere. It might happen if I was using a boom stand, it would be this signal path, and it would also be that signal path, which is considerably longer, resulting in sound waves hitting the microphone in a misaligned fashion. Or you might do that if you use a creative delay in a wrong way. Like if you use very short delays, you might create those effects yourself. Or you might have seen that in rock festivals when you have huge PA systems that use the main speaker clusters close to the stage and delay clusters further away into the audience. Now, those correlated signals, when they mix, there will be interference, meaning the signals are similar enough that really strange things can happen. Uncorrelated signals, on the opposite, can always be mixed together without these interference artifacts. For instance, if I play a note on a recorder and another one plays the same note on another recorder, there is not going to be any interference because the signals are just not alike enough. We can combine them any way we please. We can delay it, no problem with interference. If the signals are correlated, there might be some strange effects. Now, consider a sawtooth signal. I alluded to that in the first half. A sawtooth signal might come from a violin. It's here. And this is the first microphone. It's very close by. And there's a second microphone that picks it up, which is a little farther away. And if you look at those signals, you will see that they're slightly misaligned in time here. Now, what happens, since they are correlated, they will combine when you mix down the two signals. And we have seen that you can just get results from two waveforms by adding samples. Now, if we add those up in a mathematical strict fashion, we end up with this new wave shape. And from what we mentioned in the last session, this wave shape has a totally different spectrum. It has a totally different sound. So what happens is you introduce an artifact, your two microphones will not convey the correct sound, the sound will just suck. What happens is you have all wavelength in the signal that divide the distance between the microphones will amplify. Meaning there's one waveform is going like this, and when it and the other, and it just fits between the two microphones. So when the wave is going upwards on the one microphone and also upwards on the other, they will amplify. You've seen that in the example of the two sine waves. Now, if that's not the case, if the signal goes upward at the one microphone and goes downward at the other, they will cancel out. Unfortunately, this is dependent on the frequency, because it's a matter of whether the waveform fits between the microphones or not. So this effect is not constant over the whole spectrum, but it does different things with different frequencies, which it implies that sound will be totally screwed up. And this is called the Kuhn-Filter effect. Typical Kuhn-Filter sound is hollow, and it's totally immune to corrective equalization. Once you have a really strong Kuhn-Filter, you can equalize till kingdom come, and will just have no effect. And this is because you will have this particular spectrum. This is the original saw wave here, and this is actually the combined two saw waves. And you will see that there are dips in the frequency spectrum where these cancellations occur. And there is actually a whole lot of them. And you can't correct it with equalization because these frequencies are just not there. And if a frequency is not there, you can't boost it. So basically, if you have Kuhn filtering, you have a problem, you have to fix the problem, no chance with equalization. So what you can do is you just apply a corrective delay to the leading signal. If I delay this signal here by this time period so that it exactly aligns, I will be fine. To do that, you need a delay unit, either self-contained or in your computer. And to find the correct amount of delay, you first do a rough calculation. That is, you use the formula we mentioned earlier on. That is, the time that you need is the distance divided by the speed of sound. And you get a figure in the low millisecond range. And first of all, you just use that. And you move it around a bit until you can hear that the sound is as full as possible. It's something you have to check by ear. Because what happens, this Kuhn filtering effect sounds very hollow. And if you feel the signal goes farther away from you, you have that Kuhn filtering, and you just tweak the delay until the sound is as loud, basically, as it can get. Another interesting effect is called the Haas effect, named by some scientist whose first name I happen to forget. Timing is crucial to our perception of direction. What happens is, if you have two sound sources that hit you with a difference of less than 30 milliseconds, they will blend into one, but if it's more, then it's sort of an echo. For instance, you may have noticed that when you're in very ambient rooms, sometimes when you clap, it's just a continuous sound. Sometimes you will go when those things are so far apart that you can actually perceive them as different. So this is one part of the Haas effect. The other more interesting part for our purposes here is that the ear is very, very sensitive to which hits earlier. Actually, even if the second sound that comes in is a lot louder, our perception of direction is the first one. And we can exploit that for huge PA systems at rock festivals. What we do is, imagine you're far away from the stage. Here's the main rig, and you're standing so far behind that you are near the delay towers. Now, you don't want to have the impression that the sound comes from the delay tower, because that's pretty stupid. You see the musicians there and the sound over there, and it would totally screw up your life experience. What you want is the impression that it comes from the stage. Now, what you do is, normally, you delay the delay lines, that's why they call delay lines, to the exact amount that the sound lines up. But now you exploit the Haas effect, and you delay them a little less, so that the main PA rig will hit your ears just a little bit earlier than the relay stuff, the delay line. And this will sort of fool your direction perception. You will have the impression that the sound comes from the stage, although the power, the sense of loudness and the sense of, you know, bodily perception that loud rock music conveys, will, all the energy will come from the delay, but your brain will conveniently think it comes from the stage. In the studio, when you play around, you can do interesting panning tricks with short delays by exploiting this fact. For instance, you take a signal that's dead mono, and you don't pan it around with a pan pot, you just delay one side. And you will see that there's a similar effect. I would encourage you to play around with that a bit. Now we can, after that corrective use, we can, of course, use delay creatively. Everybody will have used echo effects, which is basically some sort of feedback loop like this. You have the normal signal, you feed it back through a delay. And here's a short attenuator, which reduces the signal so that eventually it dies away. If you leave out the attenuator, of course, what you get is feedback. And then you can tweak a number of things. Now, an interesting thing with digital audio workstations is you have the option to do track delay. That means you can basically delay any track you want. Like the RDAT has that feature, or other tape-based workstations. And of course, in the computer, you can also put them to the front, but there's nothing different in principle. Now, you can use track delays to change the feel of tracks. Like, you delay the bass, so it will sound more laid back compared to the drums. And you can also, of course, use track delay to compensate for a comb filtering effect. Okay, questions so far? You don't have to, but you could. Okay, doesn't seem to be the case, so Steve is... Oh no, it's... Wait, do we have digital stuff now? Oh no, we didn't, because digital delay, as you have seen in the first session, is just trivial. It basically means you store something, and then you retrieve it when you need it. So there's not much to it, that's why Steve is taking a break right now. Next thing, and this is where it gets interesting again, is controlling spectrum or doing equalization. First, why would we want to do equalization? The ideal audio chain is perfect. It has linear frequency response, no sound coloration, but of course it does not exist. So we need a way to tweak the frequency response, either to correct for such deficiencies or in a purely creative way because we want it to sound different. We can accomplish this by using filters, and a bunch of filters grouped together is usually called an equalizer. I mean, that's trivial. I'm not telling you anything new. Now, filters are basically frequency-selective circuits. They are electronic devices that do things to your signal current depending on the frequency. Now, you might want to recall your physics at school. There are two very basic components that have that frequency-dependent behavior. It's capacitors and inductors. We're going to look at them just briefly to see, so that you can see how equalizers work and what limitations are to equalizers. First of all, let's look at capacitors. Capacitors, basically, it's a gap in the cable where there's two metal conductors so that no current can flow from one side to the other. However, they can store electrical charge. When current flows in, there's be a surplus of electrons here. Now, electrons have an electric field, pretty much similar to magnetism. That is, they can not get over, but they can push the electrons on the other side away. What that means is no DC-DC is direct current goes through. There's no actual current flowing through it. But if there's a change in current here, the electrons here will be pushed. So if I have high frequencies, which is the case in audio signals, which is alternating current, not direct current, something can actually get through. So at high frequencies in alternating current, the electrons don't flow, but they merely jiggle because they go a little way and then the voltage changes direction, they go back and forth. And you can imagine that this will actually pass the capacitor. Now, if the frequency is very high, it will almost look like a piece of wire, and its capacitive reactance, which is resistance in AC terms, is very low. And this corresponds to the following formula. You have a frequency dependence here. The resistance of the capacitor is inversely proportional to the frequency. There we have something to build an equalizer with. And this is exactly what we do. One slight problem, which I'm just going to mention in passing, is capacitors introduce phase shift. That means normally the current, the electrons flowing, and the voltage building up are together. They are moving together. Current, voltage. Now what happens in a capacitor is that the current starts leading the voltage, and they go like this. But it's not really of any practical importance on this level. Okay, now you can build a simple circuit out of a capacitor here. You add a resistor, and you have a little voltage divider. Now what happens is you have, this is the input, this is the output, and you have a frequency-dependent capacitor here. So this thing will change its resistance over the frequency, and this, of course, will change the sound because some frequencies pass more easily than others. What happens is you will get this frequency response. It's a basic high-pass filter that has a roll-off of 6 decibels per octave, meaning the loudness will decrease by half. It will have roughly half the loudness, 1 octave lower. And there's a couple of formulas here that you might want to consider or not. In principle, it's just the fact that with just a capacitor, we already have a frequency-dependent circuit. Now, there's also an inverse component. It's the inductor. It's a little more tricky with an inductor. Inductor basically is a coil of wire which can act both as a magnet, as an electromagnet, and, as we've used with microphones, a voltage can be induced into it by a magnetic field. Now, it can both produce a magnetic field and be influenced by a magnetic field. And the interesting thing is, when you have direct current flowing through a coil, the magnetic field is static. Static magnetic fields do not induce voltage, which is a pity, because otherwise we could solve all our energy problems by just wrapping a couple of meters of wire around a magnet and be done with it. Unfortunately, it's not the way it works. So no induction takes place. But when the current changes and the magnetic field thus changes, and as is the case if you feed an audio signal through, the field changes and a voltage is induced into the very same coil. It induces the voltage into itself. And for obvious reasons, it's opposite to the original. Again, if it wasn't, we would have no energy problems in the world. But it's a matter of conservation of energy that it's opposite. It reduces the current that passes through the coil. Now, the faster the field changes, the stronger the self-induction, and the stronger is this opposing current. Thus, the higher the frequency, the higher the inductive reactance. And the formula here is this, and you might notice that it's not inverted. It's actually just the opposite behavior to the capacitor. Again, we have the problem of a phase shift. Now, we can again exploit it with the very same circuit layout, but the frequency response is just the opposite. So now we have a high-pass filter and a basic low-pass filter. And of course, you can make those circuits arbitrarily complex to change the exact properties. Now, there's a couple of variants of equalizers. Those that we've seen before, the circuits that affect all frequencies below or above a certain point are called shelving filters. That's what you usually have on a mixing desk for high and low, or on a cheap stereo, the sound are shelving filters. You can also combine those high and low pass filters for band pass or peaking filters. You see one here, which basically lets through only a limited range and blocks both high and low frequencies. Here's a very simple band pass circuit. It's just made by superimposing the two circuits you've seen before. Now these, since they can only remove energy, they're called passive filters, and it's not what you are used to on a mixing desk, because you can also boost. Now when we add amplifiers, we can sort of modify this a little bit, and then we have filters that can also boost a certain frequency. And the slope of the filter means the steepness of the frequency response can be changed by cascading. Like if you put two in a row, it will not slope with 6 dB, it will slope with 12 dB. And there's a number of engineering tricks you can apply, which I don't understand, so I'm not going to talk about it, but there's a number of variants. Now, to the practical appliance, the parametric EQ is that what most sophisticated analog mixing desks have, and since it can be done so cheaply, every digital audio workstation has a couple too. You have a number of tweakables there. It's, of course, the center frequency. We say where actually in the spectrum it's going to happen. You can adjust the gain either to reduce a certain frequency or to increase it. And you can also affect the slope of this peak. You can have a wide slope or a narrow slope, which is called the bandwidth, or in another measure, the Q factor. But for our purposes, I'll just stick to bandwidth. Now you have the center frequency, which is just a dip of the thing. And the bandwidth is, that's important to know, since these roll-offs are very gradual, they actually never really reach that line here. It's just defined as the minus 3 dB points for practical purposes. Now, a typical mixing desk equalizer usually has two parametric, or in this case, semi-parametric, they have fixed bandwidth filters here, and a shelving filter for the highs and the lows. Oh yeah, Steve, it's over to you.
Is that better?
Yep.
Okay, so we've got this single sample delay line, which is added to the sort of current live sample, and then this 0.5 factor just brings it back down to the original level. If you don't have that, it would be a low-pass filter and an amplifier. So the mathematical expression for it is YN. We use Y is the convention for the output signal, X for the input signal. So YN is XN, current sample, plus XN minus 1, the previous sample, divided by 2. But lots of variations on the first order This is called an FIR filter because it's not recursive. So you sometimes have different gain factors for the different factors here to achieve different slopes, but this is the simplest one. And you have this low-pass rollover slope, so it passes no signal at all at the Nyquist frequency and everything at zero, and it's this kind of smooth curve. Yep, and it's just made from delay, mix, and gain. That's all it is. So all filters of this kind of basic normal filters are just combinations of delay, mixing, and gain. That's all there is. Okay, so internal arrangements of EQs. This is the arrangement you have if you're using peaking filters. So they're just a serial arrangement of filters. And each one of these boosts or cuts part of the frequency range slightly with like parametric EQ is done like this generally. The disadvantage of this is that the phase shift from each of these filters builds up. So if you've got a large, say like a six-band parametric, it can actually become quite substantial. And you couldn't do something like an IEC standard 33-band EQ because the phase shift would just be enormous by the end of the chain. And you get gradual build-up of distortion in both analog and digital systems. So the alternative arrangement is this parallel system, which tends to be used. I've only done three here to make it more obvious what's going on. But tends to be only used if you've got a large number of bands. And the bottom one is a low pass. These middle ones, there'd be 10 or 20 or something, are all band pass, and this is a high pass. And they're tuned very carefully so that the tails from the band pass filter are adjacent band pass filters meet up exactly to get a flat response when all the controls are flat. That tuning is extremely hard, and in practice, it's never quite perfect. And you still have the problem that you have sort of slight variations in phase shift across the frequency range. But for EQs with large number of bands, you basically have to do it this way to avoid the phase shift and distortion problems. Back to you.
All right. Now it's just some boilerplate ideas on how you could use an equalizer. My zero, very personal zeros rule is listen. Before you use an equalizer, just make sure you understand how the original signal sounds. What I usually do before I start fiddling with the equalizer is I walk up to the performer, which usually irritates the hell out of them, so it's especially interesting to do that. And you just, here's the singer, and you just stand here and just close your eyes and memorize how it sounds, because with somebody who don't know, you have no reference. Get this reference. Find out how it sounds in nature without the electronics interfering and try to recreate that. Now then, first rule, everybody will probably have heard that, the best EQ is no EQ at all. That is, don't try to compensate bad microphone placement. Just walk up, stand up and walk there and move the microphone around, because the result will be a lot better. And you can't compensate cheap mics. If you want good sound, you need good equipment. And I know many people who are starting to get gear together to do audio, and they have a shabby room, and they have shabby speakers, and a shabby mixing desk, and they buy an expensive 30-band equalizer to correct for the deficiencies in their speaker system. Don't do that. It's just a waste of money. Now, shabby room acoustics, the same. It's often you can't help it. That's why we have an equalizer, so we can do, if we can't change the room acoustics. But first of all, try to do that. If it's overly bright, like it might happen here, close the curtains before, you know, fiddling with the high end, because it will have a number of side effects. Now, my second rule is when you use active equalizers, down is good, up is evil. For the simple reason that, of course, it's easier to boost because you clearly hear what you're doing. It's a lot harder to hear how to attenuate something. But most of the time, you will have boomy frequencies, that is, frequencies that need attenuation. And the normal reaction of somebody who is new to using equalizers is just to boost everything else, resulting in a frequency response roughly like that, you know. And you don't want that. So first check if there's anything that might need attenuation, and after that try to boost stuff that might need a bit more presence. And then if you work with semi-parametric or fully parametric filters, which can be hard, the sweep is your friend. What you do is you boost the gain, and you use the frequency to sweep through the entire audio range, which will nicely highlight the frequency bands, like a searchlight. You sort of can get used to how it sounds. Like if you have do a drum sound check and the guy's going with his bass drum, you can just sweep and you will hear the where the power is, the impact is, where the click is, the funk is, and you can just learn that, and you can do that with your sweep. Now, if you do have a fully parametric filter, which is not that common, you have also the bandwidth. I would start with low Q, meaning have a very broad filter, high bandwidth. Just try to accomplish what you want to do with this broad bandwidth, and then you narrow the bell until what you're trying to accomplish is lost again, so that you try to correct as little as possible in as small a range as possible. Right. Another good recommendation is to A/B compare frequently. Like if you have a EQ bypass and you start working on a single signal for like 5 minutes, your ear gets accustomed to all kinds of crap, and you forget how it really used to sound. So switch off the equalizer and recalibrate your internal reference. Or if you're working with live musicians, leave the control board, walk up again to the performer, and try to recalibrate your reference. And then another important rule is many people don't realize is you can't boost what's not there. Basically, I mentioned that with the comb filtering effect. If you have comb filtering, there are cancellations of frequencies, meaning there is nothing, absolutely nothing left to boost. All you will boost is noise, and you will induce all kinds of weird phase shifts. So you have to correct misalignments and interference, and you can't do it with an equalizer. Now, and another nice thing is I've been mixing a couple of hip-hop bands lately with kids who were doing really great music in their home studios, and of course they wanted that low end, you know, really kicking it. And what they did is they had everybody has shelving filters. Now, shelving filters don't just boost what you hear, but also everything below, which your monitor system might not be able to reproduce. So it sounds really great on your small monitors because all that really, really nasty low frequency garbage around 20 hertz is just not played back when you mix, but it's there. So these kids come with their CD and they just, you know, stick it in and listen to it on a big PA system with like 4 18-inch speakers per side, and suddenly it doesn't work anymore. So if you do that, either you care for it when mixing and be very careful with bass shelving filters, or you give it into the hands of a good mastering engineer who will, of course, then just apply a small high pass to get rid of those really, really low frequencies that consume much energy but don't really give any feel to the music. And then, of course, if there's some smartest walking up telling you how to use an EQ, tell them just to get lost, because basically everything you need to do is okay. And all I'm saying, you know, I'm sort of a sound fascist. I'm really into natural sounding classical music. So all these rules apply when you want to recreate something with high fidelity. If you just want to create your own sound, forget all of that, of course. Any questions as to equalizing?
No one? 15 minutes to go. You were quite fast, so I'm not quite sure if anyone on IRC is fast enough to ask a question, but none right now.
All right.
So then, just go on.
Okay, on to the next chapter, controlling dynamics using compressors and expanders. Let's just agree on a couple of terms. What's that? Oh, it's a fan, right.
It's fan, yeah.
Okay. The difference between the softest and the loudest passages is usually termed the dynamic range of a signal, which might vary, of course. In pop music is very low, in classical music it's usually considerably larger. Now, I just coined two terms for usage here. One is macrodynamics, which I say is the loudness difference between sections in the music, such that the chorus might be loud, the verse might be soft, the bridge might be have a short crescendo to it, and the solo might be really screaming loud. Macrodynamics is what in classical notation you would denote with things like forte, piano, and the like. Now, microdynamics is the peakiness of the signal. Imagine a pipe organ which just, you start the sound, it basically remains the same over the time. And a drum has this very, very intense, transient peak, and then quickly fades to nothing. So this, I would just say, this has a high microdynamics. Now, those short percussive peaks are called transients. Why compression? In an ideal world, of course, all media are good enough to reproduce the original dynamic range, and all listening environments are quiet enough so that the very soft music does not get drowned in noise, and all listeners are attentive and knowledgeable enough to enjoy music like that. Okay, right, forget it. We have to do something about that if we want to sell it to anybody. So microdynamics can be controlled just by manually doing gain riding, having one hand on the fader, and when you see, okay, the difference between chorus and verse is a little too much, then you reduce the chorus by, say, 3 dB manually, which is always going to sound better than if you do it automated. But microdynamics happens so fast that you need some automatic means of control, and that's where the compressor comes in. Now, how do I compress? You can think of a compressor as an extremely quick audio engineer doing gain riding. He has a pair of ears, he measures the signal, monitors it, and then reacts to changes in the level. Now, listening here means that you measure the signal loudness. Like you have a sort of internal oscilloscope, you look at the voltage, and you can either look at the peaks, or you can compute the energy that's in the signal by using root mean square algorithm. Peak compressors react to transients, and RMS equalizers compressors react to the perceived loudness. Now you get a control voltage from that, and you feed it into a voltage-controlled amplifier, which is basically an automated gain slider, and it reacts. When the control voltage goes up, well, it's not quite correct, but of course, when the signal goes louder, it is automatically reduced, and so on. Now you have a number of parameters here. First, it's the threshold. It's the level at which the compressor starts to act. You can tell the compressor, okay, all the soft stuff can go through unharmed, just don't do anything, and only if it gets loud, please reduce loudness. And you can say how much by setting the ratio, how much the reduction should be. And you can also tell them how fast to react to transients, which is attack. And there's the release, that means how quickly after it has come into action does it release the slider and moves it back to its original state. And there's also the knee, it's very subtle, to see how harshly the compression sets in. And of course, you usually have a gain reduction meter, which this one goes in that direction from here to there and tells you how loud the signal is, and this goes in the opposite direction from here to there and tells you how much the compressor reduces the signal. Now, here are the transfer functions of compressors. This is just a compressor doing nothing, or set to a ratio of 1:1. The signal comes in and goes out just as it is. Now here we have a ratio of 5:1 and the threshold is minus 30 dB. From the very soft signals to minus 30 dB, nothing happens. But here, the threshold is reached, and now this curve is flattened by a ratio of 5:1, meaning this was 5, and what's left is 1 here. Meaning 5 dB more input is only 1 dB more output. Now many people think of compressors as making things louder, which is in principle is wrong, because basically a compressor just softens the signal, except for upward compressors, which are very, very rare in practice. Now what you do when you have reduced the very loud stuff, you can use makeup gain. That is, you make the entire stuff louder until the very loudest are back to the original very loudest level, and this is the stage where a compressor actually wins you additional loudness.
Okay, so this is a typical block diagram from a simple compressor. You've got this line here represents the audio input, which just goes into an amplifier and then straight out again. And then here we've got, this is the part of the circuit that does the analysis. So we've got an input here which either comes from the main audio input, so it's just compressing its the signal's being compressed by itself, or through a sidechain input, so you can use the dynamics of another signal to control the signal that you're amplifying. So the first stage is an envelope follower, which is effectively a kind of very harsh low-pass filter. It's trying to extract the overall shape of the sound from the sort of waving sine waves and whatever. There's a gain control which handles the ratio and the threshold calculations. Right. So here's the envelope follower, which is the tricky bit. The gain correction part is pretty simple. So here we've got an example input signal, which is this is the sort of slow sine wave you can see is the envelope of the signal, like maybe one note, and the fast one is the actual tone. And this red line on here is a very bad envelope follower that I knocked up quickly in Perl to trap this signal. And you can see that you can't quite make it out. But this red signal here is reproduced in green underneath. But the red signal is bumpy because this signal goes up and down a lot, and it lags behind the green signal because it can't see into the future and it can't predict what's coming next, so it can only respond with some delay. And because it's a very harsh filter, it needs a lot of delay to look at a lot of samples into the past, so you get this lagging effect. And the tuning the envelope follower is extremely hard. I mean, this one I haven't tried to tune at all, but ideally you want to get a very smooth curve that responds quickly and decays quickly, because the lag also affects the decay time as well. But this one's not particularly tuned, but that's one of the hard things about compressor design. The actual fundamental algorithm is extremely simple. Making it sound good is 99% of the work.
Oh yeah, right. So this is where it gets into philosophy. Now, why would you want to compress? Of course, some compression can be needed because you just have a medium for which you produce that can't handle the original signal to noise. For instance, if you do classical recordings of an orchestra, a full orchestra has a dynamic range of about 120 decibel, covering everything from the hearing threshold of humans up to the pain threshold. And a CD just has 96, I'm sorry, decibels of signal to noise. So you have to reduce a little bit. In classical music, it's normally done by gain riding, of course. But it might also happen if you work for analog tape or vinyl recordings or radio, which have signal to noise ratios from 50 to down to 40 or 35 dB. So you have to do some compression, otherwise your signal will be drowned in noise. Or if you produce for car radio and other noisy environments where the soft passages simply will be drowned out by ambient noise. Now, you can, of course, also, this is all some compression, like running the entire mix through a compressor. Of course, you can also use it on single tracks, which is done in the studio during mixing for just aesthetic or creative reasons, if you want to give a singer more presence and to make one instrument stand out over the others. And then the problem is that nowadays, most often, extreme compression is used indiscriminately over the whole sum just to make it louder than anybody else, in the hope that maybe music consumers might sort of respond to it if it blows your speakers apart when you listen to the music on the radio. So this is one reason why, in my opinion, commercial pop music is really boring. It's not the musical material, it's just the sonic uniformity. And in fact, commercial pop music usually has a dynamic range of about, if it's really, really arty stuff, it's got 10 decibels or 15, which is just a sorry tenth of what our human hearing is capable of. So you lose a lot of the music, to me at least, loses a lot of interest in that. Now, some usage tips from, you know, a sound fascist like me is when you use a compressor the first time, either the first compressor in your life or a compressor that you don't know yet, first of all, you can set attack and release controls to automatic, and you should do that. And then you set the threshold to maximum, meaning it will respond only to signals that are so loud they don't occur. So basically it's neutral, it's a sort of bypass. And then you decide, okay, do I want a gentle compression or really strong effect that might sound artificial but might create the sound I'm after? So you just then set the compression, and then you move the threshold down until you begin to hear the effect, and of course you will also see the gain reduction meter kicking in. And then you calibrate the output gain or the makeup gain to line up the loudness with the original bypass signal. Because to human ears, louder is always better. And when you compare, you need to A-B switch. You need to bypass to really judge whether your compressor sounds the way you want. And there's a loudness difference. You will like the compressed version better just because it is louder. And to overcome this, you calibrate it so that the perceived loudness is the same. And then you can really judge whether the sound quality is what you desire. Now, when you've done that, you can turn the attack and release knobs to somewhere in the middle and switch to manual control. And then you can use the attack time to control how much transients, that is very quick, short happenings, will be compressed, especially that refers, of course, to drums. Now, if you feel the drums are just, you know, obnoxious, they're too loud when they hit, you can use a short attack time, meaning the compressor will react to those transients and reduce them. And if, on the other hand, you feel something, it's sounding mushy and the drums are lifeless, you would want to enlarge the attack time so that the transients can go through unharmed. Now, if it might happen that it's pumping. Pumping is basically you have one loud sonic incident which is ducking the entire rest of the band. Like whenever the drummer hits the snare, the singer has a dent in the loudness. It's drowned. It's called pumping. And it usually results from too long release times. You have to tell the compressor when it reduces transients to stop reducing the gain very quickly again, because otherwise after the transient is gone, the compressor will still be compressing, but there is nothing to compress anymore, so the normal sound will sort of get a dent. And you have to watch out when you're compressing stereo, or for that matter, surround sound. You have to do the same compression on both channels, because the ear is very sensitive to loudness variation when judging ambience. And what would happen if you don't do that, and you have, say, the drummer sits there, and the singer sits on the other side, there will be different amounts of compression, meaning the stereo image will hop left and right, most annoyingly. So that's where the stereo link switch in most compressors comes in. You might also do some other things with compressors. You might build your own de-esser, which is, basically means a device to reduce obnoxious sibilance, which you get when singers or speakers work with microphones. What you do is you have a sidechain input to most compressors. Steve mentioned that in the diagram, meaning you can, normally the control signal is derived from the original signal, but you can also feed in something else. You can control the loudness of one signal by another signal. And this is what you do. You take the original signal and run it through the compressor, and also take it and pipe it through an equalizer and boost the sibilance, the S and S and F loud sounds, so that they get really, really annoying, and you feed that extremely overdone signal into the sidechain. So the compressor will suddenly be very sensitive to S and F sounds, and it will reduce the gain, which actually, when you use it on the normal signal, means that it will only compress when these obnoxious sounds occur. And you can also do, of course, limiting, which is basically a compressor with a very high ratio. A so-called brick wall limiter has a ratio of infinity to one, meaning there is a certain point where no matter what you feed into it, the signal just won't get any louder. As you might be able to guess, this sounds very, very unnatural. And in fact, those harsh limiters are really only used to cut off the very, very loudest transients. Whenever you do that at lower levels, the sound just dies. And you do that either to protect digital media from overloading or PA systems from excessive level. That means in normal usage, the limiter shouldn't even come into effect. Right, and we have also expansion, which is basically the opposite of compression. It makes soft signals even quieter. 5 minutes? Okay. Well, we're going to skip that. Most common usage is the noise gate. Well, it's... Well, you can always read up on the slides later on. Okay, so any questions?
That was not my intention, sorry.
No, this is just planned questions. But we have an entire new chapter about space and spatialization. I think it's up to you. Either we really rush through that, or if you want to ask some general questions, you might do that now. So it's up to you. What should we do?
Don't give alternatives.
All right, we can go on for a little while if you still can stand it. Okay, right. Just to give you some ideas about spatial perception, there's two aspects of spatial perception. There's first to hear from which direction the sound comes, and then to get a picture of how distant and how far away it is, which is one aspect. And the other is to get a feel for the room. Like this room has a lot of ambient reverb. There are the Kubus, for instance, is very dry. And the staircase is even more ambient. And this is another information that we can try to convey when designing sound on CDs or anything. And both of those aspects, we can either capture them during recording, or we can fake them afterwards, which is what happens, of course, in most produced music. Now, we get a number of clues to work out the direction of a sound. Basically, this is loudness differences between the ears, which is pretty trivial. But it's not even the most important. The most important is timing differences. One ear is always, if the sound is to the side, one ear will get the sound a little bit earlier. And the brain is remarkably sensitive to that. And you will get sound coloration due to damping and reflection around the earlobes and head. Your head will change the sound. If it comes from behind, in theory, you would have no way to tell whether a sound comes from the front or from behind if the only clues you had is loudness or timing differences, because there wouldn't be any. Still, you can tell because sound that hits your earlobes from behind, well, that's trivial, has a sort of different quality to it. Now, distance can be derived from, first of all, relative loudness. Something that's softer will be perceived to be farther away. And air introduces some amount of high-frequency damping. Faraway sounds lose a lot of their clarity. And there is, of course, the ratio of direct to reverberated sound. If I'm far away from a source in an ambient room, it will have more reverberation than if I'm close. And all these can be exploited in recording. Now, to fake distance information, you use microphone placement. Basically, it's trivial. The farther away the microphone, the more ambient sound will be caught and the more distant it will sound. And there is this radius where the amount of reverberation and direct sound is equal. It's called the reverb radius. And you might move the microphone in and out of it. And you can fake damping, of course, by applying a low-pass filter, just filtering away the treble. And in pan-pot stereo, which is a sort of derogatory term of what you do with a if you have all mono signals on a mixing desk and just use the pan pot, you can fake distance, of course, by reducing volume, do more reverb, and even attenuate the mid frequencies or the presence range. Now, stereophonic recording comes in when you want to get an information of direction. For distance information, in theory, one source is sufficient, but not for stereo. So you have to have at least two sources to create that. And there's two basic stereo techniques. One is intensity stereo, and the other is phase stereo. And when you choose one, you have to think about mono compatibility. That is what happens if it's played back in mono. And how do I control the width of the stereo image? Now, intensity stereo just utilizes the brain's sensitivity to loudness differences, and it's usually done with two directional microphones that pick up sound from the front a lot louder than from the side. And I put them basically in the same spot. One is aimed there, the other is aimed there. And due to the directional characteristics, the sound coming from a particular direction will be louder on one than on the other. And the width can be of the stereo field, how far the sonic image spreads, can be controlled by the angle. But the problem is you can't do that. You can't overdo that, because you will get a hole in the middle when you turn them too far apart. And there's phase stereo, which is actually the more interesting, is accomplished by omni microphones that pick up sound from everywhere, but they are placed at a distance. That's called AB miking. And the perceived distance of the recording is controlled by the distance between the microphones. Now, this might also introduce a hole in the middle of the range when you place them too far apart. And now the stereo effect is due to the difference the sound takes to travel to the microphones. And this will introduce phasing. In intensity stereo, the microphones are at the same place, so there is no phasing problems, no phase shift. But now we have phase shift, and the problem is when we now mix it down to mono, we will get comb filtering effects. There are some other techniques, basically combinations of the two, where you use microphones that are directional and place them a little bit apart. And these are usually named after the radio stations that introduced them. This is the Dutch radio station. I think this is the French. I'm not going to pronounce it now because Francois is sitting in the front row. and these are actually standard. You can look them up everywhere. These are a combination. And they are, of course, more convincing because they provide us with two different clues about direction. OK, I'm going to skip MS. You can always read up on that. How many minutes? Okay, let's just, you know, you can do reverb, artificial reverb, and there's a couple of things you got to think about when you use it. There's phases to reverberated sound. First of all, you have a short pre-delay. When I talk at the beginning, there will be no reverb because the sound has not yet hit any walls where it could be reflected. So there's a pre-delay before actually ambient sound is happening. Then you have a number of early reflections. Now, when I do like the sound, first will have no reverb, then it will hit this wall, that wall, and that wall. And these are sort of distinct. They reach the listener as discrete signals. And after that, it gets also complicated when like the sound gets reflected three or more times, that you get a continuous tail of reverberation. Right, Steve.
Okay, so I apologize to anyone in the audience who programs Reverb, because this is a really, I don't think this is actually how they work. It's a very oversimplification. So we've got an input into the, this is a four-channel reverb for some reason, but normally you'd only have a couple of channels coming in, going into multiple delay lines of different lengths. You have an all-pass filter here, which is, sounds like a bit of an odd thing, but it's a filter which has no amplitude response across the frequency range. It just introduces a phase shift, and you tune it to get the phase shift happening at different parts of the frequency with different slopes. And then you feed it into a matrix, which takes, you've got just a grid of numbers, and you multiply this signal coming out here by that number, this signal by that number, this signal by that number, this signal by that number. The result comes out here, just adding those up, and then back into one of the delay lines. So it's kind of a constant feedback, and it's tuned to, depending on what the decay time is and the characteristics of the reverb you want, that those numbers change, and that causes it to decay away more slowly or build up in different ways. It controls, but not in any obvious way, that you... You write some algorithms to sort of calculate roughly what these numbers should be to get a desired sound. The all-pass filter's in there so that when the signal's gone round and being gained and sent back in again, you don't get comb filtering back in here, because the frequency, the phase response of the original signal and the one that's been processed round again are different, so you don't get the same dead spots in the frequency band caused by comb filtering. Another way you can do artificial reverb is convolution. If you remember the sync waveform that was used for low-pass filtering, you can do the equivalent with an impulse recorded from a room. So if you have a very powerful large monitor that plays a single click, and it's recorded by microphones at the back of the room, and that captures captures all the linear effects of the reverb in the room. It's like it perfectly captures everything. Up to the limits of the sample rate and resolution of the microphone and other inaccuracies. You can also do it by a more accurate technique, which you start with a very low frequency sine wave and then sweep it up over a couple of seconds. That's called a chirp for some reason. But then you take the recording of that signal and you deconvolve it, which I'm not going to explain, with the source waveform, the swept sine wave, and that reconstructs an impulse like that. That's how this one was captured. It's captured from a place called Voltsbad. Apologize for the pronunciation. Right, so here's an impulse, which shows the features that Johan was describing. There's the original sound, which is just an impulse in this case. These are the early reflections, or this is a reflection of the back wall, and then side walls, and maybe one or two. And then here's the tail, which includes all the fourth and fifth reflections, and you have filtering effects from bouncing off walls. So like walls tend to absorb high frequencies more than low frequencies. So that's where you get that characteristic sound. And if I play back this is the impulse that was on the previous screen, you can kind of hear some of those characteristics. It doesn't really sound like very much on its own, but if you convolve that with your input sound, so replacing every sample with one of those clicks, you would get something which accurately reproduced the acoustic character of that room, or at least the time and amplitude effects. It doesn't capture non-linearities. That was you, wasn't it?
All right, just let mention it briefly. You can do sort of, that's why I chose it, it's sort of acoustic convolution. You take a real room, and you have a dry signal, and you put a speaker in that real room and a real microphone in that room, and you feed the dry signal in there, and you re-record it. That's basically what old recordings did, to have a natural reverb chamber and exploit that as an effect afterwards. Just some usage remarks. When you use reverb units, you can tweak a number of things. First of all, it's the decay time. That's the time for the reverb to fade away, and it's defined as a time to fall to minus 60 dB of the initial signal, which is really, really very quiet. Now, the rule of thumb, which you can ignore, of course, is you do a long decay in slow pieces with slow tempo, and short decay times for faster ones, because if you have long decay in fast pieces, so many of the impulses will overlap that it will sound mushy. You can also control the pre-delay, which is the amount between the original sound and actually any reverb coming. And you can sometimes exploit that to increase intelligibility. If the reverb starts too early, you have no clue what the speaker is saying. But if it starts a little late, then you can deduce the actual consonant sound before the ambience hits. But you have to be careful. If you do it too long, you get sort of an echoing effect or a slapback delay. And you can, of course, sometimes you can control high-frequency damping, meaning you can sort of create the image of a carpeted room or of a very hard room. Okay, we're going to skip that to give you some time for questions. And by the way, here's some references. You can download the entire stuff if you want. Here's some references that you might want to read up or not. This is what I used, and Steve also. Well, that's it, basically. So, questions?
So I'm really sorry to say that we are slightly late and we can't have much questions now. In fact, we can't have any. Otherwise,
great,
all of the rest would be late.
Find out. We have no idea what we're talking
For instance, I have to lead this guy over now because he's doing his talk in the other room now. So if you have more precise questions, please contact him directly. You find all of the slides on the web, these extremely well-prepared slides, which was also the opinion on the web. So thanks a lot for that. And then we continue in 5 minutes or 5 to 10 minutes with Victor Lazzarini on developing spectral signal applications, someone like that.